listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. What do you do if you're a Republican and you have some way of messing with the largest unionized employer in the United States? I mean, a way to seriously damage them. You take it, right? So back in 2006, there was a piece of relatively innocuous legislation that came out of the U.S. House of Representatives to reform the Postal Service, to bring them up to speed. Actually, the Postal Service at that point in time was making a profit. And they were talking about using electric cars. They had the largest single-owner fleet of vehicles in the United States. And they were talking about electrifying at least half of them. It would have been a huge jumpstart for the electric car industry. It would have been a huge slap in the face to the fossil fuel industry and the Koch brothers and all their buddies there. And it was the largest unionized employer in the country, the Postal Union. Second largest employer in the country behind Walmart, which, of course, is not unionized. So this piece of legislation came out of the House to help the post office, you know, move along and come into the 21st century. And it went over to the Senate, and something interesting happened. For some reason, somebody in the Senate decided, let's require the post office to pay over a 10-year period in advance all of the health care retirement costs for all of their workers 75 years from now. People who have not even been born yet, let's require them right now to prepay those health care costs. Of course, this is a mind-boggling amount of money. It turned out to be $10 billion a year over a 10-year period, and it has wiped out the post office. This was in 2006. Here's Congressman Peter DeFazio describing how it happened.
Well, it was really a dark-of-the-night thing. There was a pretty non-controversial bill in the House for some postal reform, which was to extend new authority to them to partner with UPS and FedEx. So we were extending that authority. At that point, they didn't have the authority to do that. And then the bill went over to the Senate, and someone at some point snuck in a section in the Senate that no one quite understood at the time. It talked about retirees' health insurance and prepayment. And the bill came back to the House, lame duck session of Congress, virtually Christmas Eve. I think it was actually 2 days before Christmas. Voice vote. No one noticed this change the Senate had snuck in. And that's how it happened.
And so Senator Bernie Sanders introduced legislation last year to fix that. It got 62 votes in the Senate, went nowhere. That included 14 Republicans. Went nowhere in the House, of course, which is Republican controlled. He has a new one that has 28 co-sponsors. But so far, it hasn't gone very far, and, of course, nothing in the House of Representatives. And meanwhile, Senator Carper has introduced a bill, along with Tom Coburn, Democrat and Republican, only two co-sponsors, not 28 like Bernie's, that would cut Saturday delivery and do a lot of other nasty things to the post office and doesn't do away with this middle-of-the-night thing. Dan Soifer is the executive vice president of the Lexington Institute, lexingtoninstitute.org, and apparently a big fan of the Carper-Coburn bill to kneecap the post office. Do I have that right, Dan? Don?
Good to talk with you, Tom. It's certainly a bill that recognizes some of the political realities that would need to happen for something to get passed and become law.
In other words, let's kowtow to the Republicans.
Well, I wouldn't say necessarily that I'm a big fan of the legislation. What I am, though, is a fan of Congress figuring out a way to get something done to address a problem that's only...
But when I hear people use that kind of language, you know, acknowledge political realities, get something done, typically what it means is kiss the asses of the Republicans. Frankly, you know, pardon my French, but I think I can say that on the air. And that certainly seems like, you know, that... And I don't see why we should do that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that your introduction to the issue was spot on. I think that accurately hit all the important nuances of this. I think with the one exception that fundamentally we have an institution that lost, you know, $16 billion last year that is in danger of getting into sort of Detroit auto bailout size losses.
All because of this thing, this poison pill that was inserted by a Republican in the Senate in 2006.
Well, all because of the legislation that was passed in 2006. This one poison pill that you described, and I do think you described it well, it requires the Postal Service to pre-fund $5 billion a year.
$5 billion a year, yes. $50 billion total over a 10-year period.
But the Postal Service lost $16 billion last year, so it was an important part of the equation.
But wait a minute. They lost $5 billion in 2006, $5 billion in 2007, $5 billion in 2008, $5 billion. Pretty soon it starts to add up. Pretty soon it cripples your ability to do things. Pretty soon it cripples your ability to market and advertise and compete. Pretty soon you start scaling back on things, which they've been doing. And guess what? It puts a company into a death spiral. Any company.
I do agree that pre-funding mandate is problematic.
It's more than problematic. It was a poison pill. This was an attempt by the Republicans to and by the way, Carper and Coburn's bill has a provision in it that basically starts taking apart the union. I mean, this is all about destroying the largest unionized employer and one of the largest unions in the United States. Pure and simple.
It is. And it does. And the approach that the Senate legislation took, in contrast to a bill that passed the House, where the Senate bill would, for instance, the Congress has forever put really strict rules on the management of the Postal Service about what it can and can't do to make or lose money.
Right.
And none of these bills fundamentally change that. And in fact, each of the bills in different ways puts more restrictions on the leadership of the Postal Service, who's responsible for balancing their budget, because your listeners should remember that the Postal Service is self-sustaining. It doesn't rely on taxpayer dollars. It generates the revenue that it needs for its operating funds.
All right, and this is something that's unique to the last 30 years or so.
Yes, yes. And I don't know if it's sustainable moving forward or not, because the model that we've always used before, which is that monopoly consumers like you and me, when we wait online and buy a stamp and mail a letter, half of the money that stamp costs, half of that 40 cents as the price of a stamp has gone up, has gone towards subsidizing other functions of the Postal Service that are not making money. And that always used to be adequate. As you said before, the Postal Service was always generating a small profit.
Oh, and I think they would be.
We need to find new ways to fund the business model.
I think they would be now if they were allowed to do other things. I mean, there's so many different things. Post offices in other countries, you know, they have banking capabilities. They can provide email capability. They could give Gmail a run for its money. I mean, there's all kinds of things that the post office could be doing. But they're not allowed to by law. They're blocked from all of these things. Rural post offices could become basically community centers. You know, there's just which in the old small town, you know, where the post office was a part-time thing, and in some small towns it still is, actually works. But please forgive my earlier kiss their butt language. That was inappropriate. I'm upset about this.
Your introduction was right. The
my apology, Doc.
Well, you know, no one really knew what the implications of that were going to be, and now it's a whole different landscape for the viability of the Postal Service.
Yeah, and my apology to anybody who may have been offended by it. But why promote Carper's bill, which only has one co-sponsor, Tom Coburn, who's a pretty toxic guy in my opinion, instead of Bernie Sanders' bill, which has 28 co-sponsors? It's sitting there right now. And it fixes the post office and doesn't do away with the union. Is that why? Because the political realities are that the Republicans won't do anything that keeps the union in place?
I don't think any of the bills being talked about now are adequate to really solve the problem. I think we have to go back not just to the legislation, the 2006 legislation, but ultimately go back to 1971 and the legislation that Richard Nixon signed and how this is organized. And the questions you asked before about other things and other activities that the Postal Service should be allowed to do that it's doing in Italy and around the world. In Brazil, they can't build post offices fast enough. I think that has to be part of the equation.
Yeah. Okay, good point. Maybe we should reconsider Ben Franklin, started the first post office, his notion that this is something that is a legitimate function of government. It is, after all. Hang on just a second.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It is, in Article 1 of the Constitution, Section 8. Dan Soifer, LexingtonInstitute.org. Thank you, Dan.
Anytime.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And, we got to do something about the damage that the Republicans did with this 2006 poison pill to the post office. And I would predict that, and I'm going to be debating it tonight on TV, as some of you just heard, And I would predict that the Republican position on this would be, you're just trying to protect those union workers, those good government, those overpaid government jobs. Now, I remember, you know, most of American history, government jobs were the lowest paid jobs. Private sector jobs paid more. People only went for government jobs because there was job security. Now, because the government sector is the only sector that still has any fragment of unions left, and the government can't declare bankruptcy and shed its unions the way the private sector has been doing, government jobs pay, in many cases, more than private sector jobs. Now, I look at that and say, why don't private sector, you know, why don't we do something to make sure that private sector jobs pay what they used to, that they pay more than government jobs? But others look at that and go, hey, it's a race to the bottom. Let's dive to the bottom, right? We don't need no stinking good middle-class jobs that one person can raise a family on. That was the last era. That was your dad's time. Come on. I mean, that was back when the billionaires, the CEOs, only made 30 times what their workers make. Now they make, you know, 1,000 times, 3,000 times, in some industries as little as 400 times what their workers make. But they got to take that money. I mean, you know, if they only made 30 times what their workers make, then the minimum wage could actually keep up with productivity. And if the minimum wage had kept up with productivity since the day Ronald Reagan took office, it'd be $22 an hour right now. And holy cow, at $22 an hour, CEOs can only afford to take 30 times what their workers make, like it used to be. Victor in Pueblo, Colorado. Hey, Victor, Postal Service?
Yes, sir. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
And I've petitioned our government for a long time to get rid of it altogether.
Of the Post Service? Postal Service?
Yes. To abolish it. It's out of date. It's nothing but a funnel for the elite.
You mean those elite postal service workers?
The whole program needs abolished.
Because it's just wrong that a person retired and on Social Security can send a letter across the country or around the world for about 50 cents. They should be able to have $12 to send it by Federal Express.
Well, and the thing, if they did away with it, the other ones, FedEx and UPS, would take up the slack, and
then
the prices would drop.
Oh, yeah, we've seen that happen so many times. When the big giants squash the last of their competition, they just radically drop their prices. Microsoft did it, Apple did it, FedEx, and now, come on, Victor, do you seriously expect me to, do you actually believe that?
Oh, yeah.
Do you actually believe that if the post office went out of business, that FedEx and UPS would start charging 50 or 60 cents to deliver a letter anywhere in the United States?
Well, you've got all these other little independent places that are picking up that slack already where you can go in and for a nominal fee for a month get good service. And
for a nominal fee? You're talking about these outlets that used to be the privately owned pack and ship centers, but now they're all owned by either Federal Express or UPS.
No,
they've become like McDonald's franchise.
A lot of little ones popping up in littler towns, and they're working just great. People are loving them.
And they either hand the stuff off to the post office if you want to send it cheap, or they hand it off to FedEx or UPS if you want to send it expensive.
Right.
You want to do away with the cheap option. I don't understand why. Other than that you don't like protecting the elite people on Social Security taking home $8,000 a year.
I'm on Social Security.
Pardon?
And I am a veteran.
Okay.
And I attack this from a bigger scene that people don't see, that I've been around all my life.
Okay, so who are...
There's only the elite get them jobs with the...
Who are the elite?
That's what I call organized criminals.
Okay, could you...
Where I grew up, the elite get all the contracts to do the road work. The elite get all the good jobs. And they call it Little Sicily down in Florence. Now, I'm a victim of a vicious attack down there, okay? Now, I'm not the elite.
So I still don't get who the elites are. Are you talking about union members? Are you talking about white people? Are you talking... You know, This is an elite that's within the middle class, presumably,
well,
right?
Well, in America, the elite, to me, is a definition of organized criminals. Mainly,
what's
the
crime?
Mafia, which you see on TV right now, this Belger, he's been on the witness.
Whitey Bulger. Belger, whatever, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Bulger, I thought it was. Yeah.
Anyway, how long has he been working under the witness protection program?
I don't think that Whitey Bulger was a postal employee.
No, but still, these organized people that get away with that kind of stuff.
Well, he was bribing the FBI, and the FBI was corrupt. And, I mean, you know, this that was an American tragedy, and justice is being served, at least to some extent right now. I don't understand what that has to do, you know, because some organized criminal got brought down. Was it that he was Irish?
No.
Is that
no,
the elites?
But see, now, that's it. The U.S. does cater to organized criminals, not just the Irish mafia, the Italian mafia, the Chinese mafia, the German mafia. Look what happened. They brought the Germans over here that should have been in prisons for murdering millions of Jews. What did we do? We infiltrated them into our system, give them good jobs.
Well, we put a bunch of them in our rocket programs. They're scientists, and we put a bunch of them at the head of the CIA. But beyond that, I think there was, you know, pretty good assimilation. Victor, I still fail to understand it. My apologies. Maybe it's right in front of me and I'm missing it. But I don't see what's elite about being a postal worker, and I don't see what's elite about being a person who wants to send a letter for less than a buck. But, you know, keep at it. Thanks a lot for the call. 28 minutes and change past the hour. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Yeah, it's Anything Goes Summer. What the heck? Oh, we've got some news for you, too. I'll share that with you right after the break. Okay, so you bust up the unions, you take the largest unionized employer in the United States, and you break them off. Check! 2006, the Republican plan to destroy the middle class in America. And make sure that Americans blame it on the Democrats. Because after all, you want to keep your gun, don't you? I mean, you know, this is how the logic goes, right? So, check. Let's see. Old people are voting. Oh, my God. We can't have that. Old people voting? Old people are on Social Security and Medicare. Social Security and Medicare were Democratic plans that were called socialism and communism, respectively, by Herbert Hoover and Ronald Reagan, Republicans. And the Republicans have been trying to destroy since they were passed in 1935 and 1965. So old people shouldn't be allowed to vote. Governor Pat McCrory of North Carolina just signed the bill yesterday afternoon. Didn't have a ceremony, didn't invite the press in. He just did it. Signed the bill. Then he released a little YouTube video. Yeah, we're trying to protect the vote. So, you know, if you're elderly and your driver's license has expired and you threw it away or you've lost it or whatever, or you've moved and it's not your address anymore, forget about trying to vote. Ain't going to happen. Black people voting. African Americans. Oh, my God, we can't have African Americans vote. They tend to vote Democratic. The Democrats, after all, championed the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act of 1964 and 65. We can't, you know, can't have African Americans voting. 70% of the African Americans in North Carolina voted on a day other than Tuesday, other than Election Day. In the last two elections, 70%. The majority of them voted on Sunday, the Sunday right before the election. In fact, there's a name for it. It comes out of the black churches. It's souls to the polls. The souls to the polls program is you go to church, hear an inspiring sermon, sing, have cake and cookies afterwards or something to eat, and then y'all drive down to the post office or down to the polls, the voting station, and you vote. Might be the post office in some cases. So Governor McCrory in North Carolina and the Republicans, they said, okay, early voting is fine the week before the election, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. But poor people, working poor people, and particularly African Americans with the whole souls to the polls thing, they like to vote on Saturdays and Sundays. So we're going to make early voting illegal on Saturday, Sunday, and Monday before the election. Why are you doing this? People say, well, they're saying we're trying to prevent voter fraud. Oh, I see. People who vote on Sundays are fraudulent. People who vote on Tuesdays aren't. Well, no, people who vote on Tuesdays are people who can get the day off work without having to lose a day's paycheck. And, I mean, you know, there are some people who are paid by the hour who will still take off Tuesday to vote if that's the only choice. So for them, to really discourage them, we're going to cut the number of voting machines. We're going to consolidate the precincts. We're going to make sure that their line is 10 hours long. You're not going to get a paycheck at all for that Tuesday. Oh, you want to vote on Saturdays? Tough. It's illegal now. Sunday? Ha! Students. Can't have students voting. Students, they haven't had their first job yet. They don't own a car. Why have a driver's license? They got a student ID. Bars will accept a student ID as identification, but not voting. No siree, Bob. Used to be you could vote with your student ID. No more. Used to be that there were advanced voter registration programs run by the schools all across North Carolina, where if you were 16 or 17 years old, you were a junior, senior in high school, they would sign you up in the school to vote if the next election happened when you had turned 18. So election day comes around. Hey, you turned 18 4 days before. You don't have to, you know, you don't have to register a year in advance and all that kind of nonsense. You can just show up and vote. No, can't have that. Students might vote as Democrats. So Governor McCrory and the Republicans in North Carolina just outlawed that. If it is not becoming obvious to you what's going on here, these people who are destroying the middle class, shipping our jobs overseas, taking all the money, putting their front people and their shills out there to pimp for them, basically. And you will hear them. I'm astounded that several times a week I hear on NPR somebody from the Competitive Enterprise Institute or the Heritage Foundation or the Cato Institute treated as if they were some kind of an expert on something. These are front groups for the right-wing corporatists and the billionaires to get their political message out, messaged in a way that might make sense to people because of the way that they, you know, the turn of phrase. Yes, there's a problem with the post office. We need to fix it. I mean, it's reached the point now where I'm pretty much not even bothering to listen to NPR any longer because there's so much right-wing bias in there. Oh, there's two sides to every story, you know. So, anyhow, enough of my rant. I'll stick with Amy Goodman if I want the news. But that said, as I said earlier, it's anything goes summer. So, and we got a board full of calls. So let's start picking them up. Dawn in Greeley, Colorado, listening on AM 760. Hey, Dawn, you are a retired postal employee. Are you one of the elite?
I didn't think I was. I wish I could put myself in that category. I'm probably worse though, Tom, because I live on disability. I got a disease during my career, which I never asked for, never expected to get. And I was really interested listening to your show one time talking or hearing you talk about the drink of worms, the helminthic therapy they were doing in Germany. That
yes.
fascinated me. And yes. I'm like, heck, I'll take a drink of worms if it'll help me. I mean, what the hey, that sounds good to me.
Yeah.
But no, I am not elite. But Victor had me so worked up. I get the feeling he couldn't pass the test. He thought he was going to get a cushy postal job, and he couldn't pass the test. And I was really lucky. I was able to get hired at the beginning of a hiring freeze. I passed the test pretty easily.
Uh-huh.
But I'm really proud of my career. there's a lot of hardworking individuals there, and we don't get all the credit we deserve, definitely. But yeah. If this happens, if they are able to do that, it's going to devastate the nation. You can count on paying a lot more for your letters and packages,
sure.
If you get them at all. We deliver so many things for UPS and FedEx. You know, they get more pay on the deal than we do, but it's just so wrong on
right.
So many levels.
Yeah, the post office offers last mile service. I guarantee in any kind of reform, that's the one thing that they'll keep. Is the last mile service that the post office uses to subsidize UPS and FedEx. Dawn, thank you for the call. It's nice to meet the elite. We've finally found them. And thank you very much. And thanks for listening to AM760. Ed in Saginaw, Michigan. Hey, Ed, what's up?
Hi, how you doing? Good afternoon.
Good. Hi.
The elite, the people that made millions during this war.
Yeah, I don't disagree. The real elites. They live all around this city. We've got the richest zip code in the United States now, just outside Washington, D.C. It's where all the war contractors live.
Yeah, I know. My daughter teaches school in Virginia.
Yeah, so you know what I'm talking about.
Yep, I know. And my question, I'm sorry, I got off track. My question is, here 15 years ago or so, Congress passed a law that each employee had to put so much away for their retirees. And now, because they filed bankruptcy, they could get away with taking that. And it was at least $60 billion with a B
mm-hmm.
in there.
Yeah.
And they gave the union stocks, and the union took over our health care and gave them stock. Now,
right.
Where did that billions of dollars go?
It went into the pockets.
They filed bankruptcy?
Yeah, it went into the pockets of the senior executives and some of the stockholders and members of the board of directors. I mean, you know, the rich, they've got 16 ways to Sunday to skim the money off the top and leave the working people with nothing. You know, they get the fillets and you get the bones from the tail, right, to use a lousy fish metaphor. But, Ed, thank you for sharing your story with us. Tim in Panama City, Florida. Hey, Tim, just a minute to the break. Quick one.
Good afternoon. I've just got one point that I'd like to make that I haven't heard anybody else bring up as far as the post office retirement program.
Mm-hmm.
They're making them pre-funded for 75 years in the future, and I think it's just for one reason. That is to get that amount so high that they plan on privatizing it. When they do, the CEO and the executives are going to raid the pension fund, walk away with billions of dollars, and then leave them with nothing.
Of course. Why did I not see that coming? It has happened over and over and over again. You get these corporate raiders, the Mitt Romneys of the world, and they go in and they buy up the companies, and the first thing they do is strip bare the pension fund and let you and I, the taxpayers, pick it up with the Federal Pension Guarantee Act, and they stick it in their pockets. And of course, Tim, I think you're absolutely right. Yes, if you're going to privatize a government organization, first make it entirely very, very rich in the one part that can be, you know, basically stolen during the privatization process, which is the pension fund. You nailed it, Tim. You nailed it. You're one of the smartest guys in the room. Thank you very much for the call. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We got to figure out who is the Republican who slipped this thing in. I'm still trying to track this down. If anybody knows, let me know. 10 minutes before the hour, welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you on your media support group for We the People, the Tom Hartman Program, the place where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person, and say, no, not a chance. Mary in San Francisco, you know who slipped that little gem into the post office bill 2 days before Christmas back in 2006?
I think I do. I think it was Daryl Issa, because he's the first one that I heard talking about it.
Well, here it was somebody in the Senate, according to Peter DeFazio, and Daryl Issa in the House of Representatives. So it might have been somebody collaborating with Daryl Issa. Daryl Issa is certainly a big advocate of it, so that's a very, very good guess. If I was just guessing without knowing that it had to be a senator, that would have been my guess, because Daryl Issa is one of the most toxic guys. I mean, he's even talking about doing away with the law here in D.C. that says that no building can be taller than the head of the goddess on top of the Capitol building. So let's build skyscrapers in Washington, D.C. It'll make money for the capitalists. It's like, destroy the city.
But I have to say, Tom, I don't know where you've been all my life, because I finally found somebody that I thought I was the only person that agreed with you.
Yeah.
And
who thought that way?
I finally found you.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Mary.
Most of it.
Thank you. That's very kind of you. I feel the same way about everybody who calls in and watches this show. It's like we're a tribe. And it's nice to have a vehicle here, all the radio stations, the Pacifica Network,
yes,
the Free
is.
Speech TV Network that connects us all together. It really, really is. Mary, I got to move along to the next caller, but thank you so much for the call, and thanks for listening there in San Francisco. George in Mobile, Alabama. Hey, George, what's on your mind today?
Hey, about the Postal Service. A lot of the problems that are about the Postal Service comes from the upper management itself.
Mm-hmm.
I retired back 2 years ago, and the Postmaster General at that time, the head of the Postal Service, retired at the same time. Well, he was given a $5 million bonus when he retired,
yeah.
But as me, as a regular worker, I was given nothing,
yeah.
Other than my regular retirement. And a lot of things they do in the management just is a big waste of money. And we see it, you know, there in the offices where, you know, we would work.
Yeah, and you know why that is, George.
What's that now?
And you know why that is.
Oh, well.
It goes back to the semi-privatization of the post office. Back in either the late 70s or early 80s when Jimmy Carter was drinking the Kool-Aid or Ronald Reagan got a hold of it. I don't remember which one it was. But Carter, the last 2 years of his presidency, he was, you know, drinking Margaret Thatcher's Kool-Aid. And they semi-privatized a bunch of government agencies, and you know, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, another one, which never should have been done. And so these quasi-government agencies started behaving like private corporations, and the senior executives started taking big bonuses and retirements. I can't speak to that $5 million. I don't have personal knowledge of it, but I wouldn't be surprised if you're absolutely accurate. But still, it was the largest, you know, unionized employer in the country, and that cannot stand. Republicans have to destroy wherever they see a union, they've got to destroy it. So I think that the post office should be completely unprivatized, frankly, along with Freddie and Fannie and Sallie Mae. And we should go back to the way these things were before the Reaganomics infection hit the United States. George, thank you for the call, and thanks for your comments. Well said. Carolyn in Marseille. Is it Marseille or Marcellus, Illinois? It's Marcellus,
well,
isn't it?
If you're local, it's Marseilles.
Marseilles. Okay, great. So what's up?
But it's like the town in France.
Yeah.
Marseille.
Yeah.
I was in Chicago Thursday at the Palmer House, and they were passing out information on Alex rules. One of the sheets, which I can't find, was about the post office bill in 2006. And it was the senator from New York that slipped this in.
Really? A Republican or a Democrat?
Well, I can't find my sheet.
Yeah.
His initials were, I believe, HH. And,
The last senator I remember with those initials was Hubert Humphrey. It definitely wasn't him.
No. He was from New York.
Yeah.
And this was the information that this was an Alex-backed.
Really? So Alec and the Koch brothers and the billionaires had their hand in this thing?
It had the little story about the head of Alex at the time. I'm not sure if he was like somebody up there. Was UPS.
Right.
And then
FedEx
in there.
Yeah, of course. UPS
and,
was a member of Alec.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes. And I'm sorry. That sheet's somewhere and I just can't find it.
Well, that's okay. I'm sure somebody will call who has the information now that you've seeded the garden here with it. It will grow. Carolyn, thank you for sharing that with us, and thank you for calling in. Carrie in Wrights, Illinois. Hey, Carrie, what's up?
Thanks for putting me on.
Sure.
I have a 1910 Webster's Dictionary.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in the back of that, it's an absolute treasure trove. In January 24th of 1907, the salaries of the Senate and the House were increased to $7,500.
Right.
Vice President, House Speaker, $12,000. So in 100 years, they went from $7,500 to a raise of $1,665 every year for 100 years.
Wow. Now, you know, inflation has had something to do with that, Carrie. And,
I understand that, but they want to belittle people trying to make a living wage?
Yeah. Well, and this is one of the great tragedies of American democracy is that I think that Bernie Sanders is one of probably only two or three people in the United States Senate who are not multimillionaires. And that in the U.S. House of Representatives last year, I believe it was, might have been the year before, was the first year in history that more than half of the House of Representatives were multimillionaires. And you've got people like Daryl Issa, who's worth, as I recall, $700 million, very, you know, almost a billionaire. And that's becoming increasingly the case, that people are so wealthy that they're buying their seats. They're buying their way into Congress. And then, of course, who do the wealthy people in Congress hang out with? The other wealthy people. And, you know, Bernie would rather go around and do town halls and hang out with working people in Vermont. But most of the senators would rather sit in a fancy restaurant here in Washington, D.C., smoke a cigar and drink a $600 bottle of wine like Paul Ryan did the other day when he got outed for that. Carrie, thank you for sharing that little bit of trivia with us. It's a gem. I appreciate it. We'll be right back. In fact, we're going to be back with Dan Bongino, a conservative commentator, former police officer. And we're going to talk about the state of police in the United States.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And on the line with me is Dan Bongino, conservative commentator, former police officer with the New York Police Department, former Secret Service agent, and currently a candidate running for Congress as a Republican in Maryland, in the 6th District of Maryland. His website is Bongino, BONGINO.com. And Dan, welcome back to the program.
Always good to talk to you, Tom.
Thank you, Dan. Always nice to have you on. You're a good guy.
Thank you very much.
Even though we disagree on so many things, I've gotten to know you over the years. You are definitely a good guy. By the way, are you running in a – is this a primary run?
There is a primary, yeah. It's
okay.
Some nominal.
Okay. So for our Republican listeners in Maryland, Dan's running for the 6th District. I don't know if it's a closed primary or not. But, so our registered Republicans listen carefully to this guy. He's a good guy. Dan, I wanted to talk with you about both the stop and frisk thing that got basically blown up by the – well, actually not. It got tempered, shall we say, by this federal judge in New York City. And also this young man, Israel Hernandez Lash, who was an award-winning graffiti artist. And being a graffiti artist means you're living kind of on the edge of the law because graffiti is graffiti, right?
Right.
And even when it's art. And a police officer demanded that he stop. He didn't. The guy tased him, and it killed him. He was shot with a taser gun when they caught him spray painting a building. Where would you prefer to start?
Yeah, well, stop and frisk is a great topic for me.
All right.
You know, me and you, Tom, actually share a lot in common. I know that surprises you sometimes, but I was a kid who drove around with a bumper sticker on my car that said, "Question authority." So the cleft between my libertarian streak and I think your streak of your interesting blend of politics, I'll call it, is actually not that.
My civil libertarian streak.
It's not as thick as some would believe. The
stop
and frisk issue is a sensitive one for me, having been a police officer and stopped and frisked people.
Mm-hmm.
But having grown up in the streets in the city, in New York City, and having been stopped and frisked myself in circumstances I felt inappropriate, you know, I've seen it from both sides. Now, I'll say this. Some of the judge, I think it was Shilin, I think some of her remedies were a little absurd, and go a little far. Having, police officers wear video cameras, I think, was a little excessive. But one of the police officers who testified in this case, apparently, I read the New York Times piece, it said that there were these informal quotas for numbers of people to go out and stop and frisk.
Right.
Well, I can tell you from my time, they're not called quotas, but they're generally called performance measures, Tom, or some other, fancy terminology you can use to not get yourself in legal trouble. And I strongly, strongly object. There's no constitutional basis whatsoever for pulling people over and then ex post facto making up a reason why you did it because you have to fulfill whatever you want to call it, a performance quota or a measure.
Right.
So that, yeah,
and now one of the things that I've heard several times, and I'm not sure if this is actually true or not, and you can tell me perhaps, Dan, is that in New York, possession of a small amount of marijuana is really not a crime. Or it's a parking ticket kind of crime.
Right, right.
But displaying marijuana in public is a crime. And this is in order to, you know, discourage people from smoking pot in public, right? Because other people have to breathe it and that kind of stuff. But if somebody's caught with pot, they, in a stop and frisk situation, they find themselves in this bizarre catch-22, because if the police officer says, empty your pockets and show me what's in your pockets, if they say no, then they're committing a crime, which is more serious than a parking ticket or a jaywalking ticket, of you know, refusing the lawful order of a police officer. And if they say yes and pull a joint out, they are now committing the crime of publicly displaying marijuana, and they get arrested for one or the other. Is that the case?
Well, what I found, no, I mean, could it be? Yes, but that's not what I found. What I found was if they wanted to arrest you, you know, one of the jokes we had was, or you'd hear people say, it was like felonious mopery or something like that, like a crime people would make up after the fact.
Right.
If they, you know, like disorderly conduct. I mean, there's these random kind of open-ended crimes you can charge people with. If you would stop and frisk them, and maybe you didn't have the exact Terry versus Ohio, that's the legal case, reasonable suspicion to do that. Those were the things that I found disturbing. Now, I didn't witness it, but you'd always hear people chatting. There was always chatter. And the cops and firemen are really good guys. I mean, I worked there, and the Secret Service agents I work with. But, you know, of course, there's always a few bad apples. And the pressure I found, Tom, was pressure coming from the bosses, not the cops. I mean, none of the cops I knew at a roll call wanted to go out there and, you know, hey, let's go out there and just randomly frisk people.
Yeah, they want to roust people.
Yeah, there's a lot of pressure from management, though. I mean, politicians want to cut crime rates, and that's where these performance measure things come in. And that's why I don't believe the politicians in this are really telling everybody, you know, the full story. The program needs to be modified. But I don't think it should be scrapped completely, and I don't think video cameras are necessarily the best way forward either.
Well, they've done actually a lot with in police cars in stopping inappropriate behavior by police officers.
Sure, and I think that's fine. But when you're on a foot post by yourself, me, I haven't been there, 2 o'clock in the morning in the 75th precinct. And again, I'm not defending illegal stop and frisk techniques. I'm not. But I'm saying if I had a video camera on me and it's 2 o'clock in the morning, there's always a hesitancy to act, knowing that they're never going to see the full context of what you're seeing. At a car stop, it's a little different. You have a microphone. It doesn't really get the whole thing. But, you know, I haven't been stopped myself, again, after I left. Mm-hmm. There is that, you know, why'd you stop me for? And it does breed distrust in the community. And I don't think there's anything more important between a police department and their community than, you know, a vibrant sense of trust. You don't trust.
Yeah, I've said this for years, and I believe you agree with me on this, that our future is in the hands of our teachers. Our present is in the hands of our police. And in both cases, they're wildly underpaid and vastly under-resourced in terms of community policing and genuine teaching.
I couldn't agree with you more, Tommy. Think about it. Who else do you pay that has the ability to take your life and your liberty as they check in for work every day?
Yeah, it's a cop, yeah.
Yeah, our public service, but, you know, our firemen as well. I mean, they're running into burning buildings. Things we run away from, they're running towards. I do agree with you, and I've said that publicly many times, that police, fire, you know, our federal agents, you know, our military, I think these are guys that should be paid. And I think the education requirements we can bump up a bit, and the salaries as well. And maybe that's a better solution, maybe better training, maybe better civilian oversight boards. I mean, the ones I found in New York City when I was there, they were a little, I found to be a little vindictive at times. There were, you know, there were times they didn't trust you at all. Like, hey, what I'm telling you is true. It's just, well, you know, I had witnesses. Here's how it happened.
Right.
So I think there are other ways to do it.
What's your take on this young man who was tased? It seems to me that at some point, tasers are, you know, we had a robust debate years ago about when a police officer should pull a gun and when they should discharge it. And I don't think we ever had that debate about a taser. And these things kill people more often than they should.
Yeah, it seems they were chasing them for a while as well. My take on this is a practical one. My time in the police academy, I found that they lowered the standards, the physical standards, for people in order to get more people to pass. This is not a man-woman thing, so it was a man-woman-woman thing where some people just couldn't pass.
Yeah.
And they did it to get more people through, and I think this is the result, Tom. More people rely on the equipment rather than, say, their ability to talk or their ability just by a good physical presence to stop a dangerous situation before it started.
Or at a certain point, aren't there some crimes like being a graffiti artist that, you know, if you can't catch the guy, you just let him go because the alternative is to possibly kill him.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's one of the reasons in New York they call off vehicle pursuits if it gets too dangerous. You know, you have to say to yourself, okay, the guy ran a red light. Is it worth running down four or five kids in the middle of the street to catch a guy and ensure he gets a ticket for a red light? I mean, you know, marginal benefit, marginal cost. And I think you make a point here in this case. But I don't know all of the details, but I know there was a foot pursuit involved, and I certainly don't think he deserves to die.
Yeah, I'm with you. Dan Bongino, his website, Bongino, BONGINO.com. He's running for the 6th District of Maryland's Republican seat. So as I said, you know, Democrats are probably not going to be there voting for you, Dan. But if there are Republicans watching, and I know that there are, check it out. Dan, thanks for being with us.
Thanks, I appreciate it.
Good talking to you. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Fascinating. Yes, there are a few decent... Now, you know, we shouldn't have a lot of Republicans in elected office, but at least let's get some decent ones in there, okay? Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Just a couple quick things I wanted to share with you. The NSA is going to have a technical advisory review group. This is the group that's going to provide some oversight to the NSA. They're going to check out what's up, and they're going to keep us informed. You know, the NSA took kind of a hit when Mr. Clapper, the guy who is the James Clapper, who is what's his exact title with the NSA? I forget. He was the spokesperson for the NSA anyway. He's the guy who spoke before Congress, and in, I believe he's the senior intelligence official with the administration. But in any case, whatever his title is, he went before Congress and lied to us, lied to Congress, lied to us. It came out when Ed Snowden did his data dump. And Clapper then went on television or in an interview and said, well, I told the least untruthful thing I could. Right. In other words, it wasn't a terrible lie. It was just a lie. So, you know, this really hurt the reputation of the NSA. And so they're going to try and clean up their act. And so they're creating this independent intelligence advisory group, an independent technical review group. And, he was the Booz Allen Hamilton Director of National Intelligence. Great. Oh, yeah, Clapper was formerly with Booz Allen Hamilton, and now he's the Director of Intelligence. So anyhow, they're creating this technical advisory group to deal with the problem of him lying to Congress. And guess who they're appointing? The Obama administration just appointed to be the head of the technical advisory group. Da-da-da! James Clapper. Yep. He's going to... within 60 days of its establishment, the review group will brief their interim findings to me, he said, through the Director of National Intelligence, and the review group will provide a final, this is the president speaking, and the review group will provide a final report and recommendations to me through the DNI no later than December 5th, 2013. The DNI Director of National Intelligence, that would be Eric Clapper. So Eric Clapper is going to inform the president about whether or not Eric Clapper lied to Congress, James Clapper, and I must be thinking Eric Clapton or something, I don't know, or Eric Holder, yeah, there's enough Erics. Anyway, James Clapper. Meet five people serving draconian drug sentences thanks to mandatory minimum laws. This is a headline over at the Center for American Progress's blog, Think Progress, and this is a really sad story. John Horner was a middle-aged guy. He worked at a fast food restaurant. He was the working poor. He had a family. He was a father. And he lost an eye. I don't know how he lost the eye, but it was apparently a painful experience because he had a prescription for painkillers. And somebody who knew him, and I don't know the details of how this person knew him, whether it was at work or whether it was a customer or what, or a friend, got busted for drugs. And they said to this guy, if you can turn somebody into us, then we'll let you go. So this guy went to Mr. Horner and said, hey, I know that you've got some pain medication, and I've really injured my back. I'm in a lot of pain, and I'm wondering if you could just, you know, give me a little bit to get me through here till I can see my doctor. And Mr. Horner said, yeah, sure, here you go. And the guy said, well, let me pay you for this. Here's $5 for your trouble or whatever. And the guy was a snitch, and Horner got 25 years in prison. And this is a minimum mandatory. When he gets out, he's going to be 72 years old, if he's still alive. A guy working in a fast food restaurant with one eye, who simply shared his painkillers, his pain meds, with another guy, who told him, quote, he could not afford both his rent and his prescription medication, end quote. So Horner said, well, here, I'll share my prescription medication with you. 25 years in prison. Tell me we are not in need of some serious repair work. Earlier, I was telling you about people we don't want to vote. Or at least, you know, the Republican Party doesn't want to vote in North Carolina. Of course, African Americans, Hispanics, old people, students, young people, poor people, working poor people, people who take the bus and don't own a car and don't have a driver's. They didn't want any of those people to vote because those people all tend to vote Democratic, don't you know? Well, now you can add another to the list. If you're a conspiracy theorist, City Clerk Janice Winfrey says she's not a conspiracy theorist. She thinks it was just a mistake. But the city went to International Outdoor, a billboard company, and said, you know, we've got this election coming up on November 5th. Would you please put up some signs, some billboards that say, your vote is your voice, with a big picture of a microphone, and then say, general election, vote November 5th. In poor, largely African-American neighborhoods in Detroit. Detroit's a little bit of a sticking point for the Republican Party right now, shall we say? Like those people in Detroit, the people who live in Detroit, just got their city council and their mayor taken away from them, their elected officials taken away from them, because the governor of the state, Rick Snyder, imposed his little dictator law. Kevin Orr now is his little dictator, and he's running the city like a prince. So they put up the billboards, and the billboards say, your vote is your voice, general election, vote September 2nd. Not November 5th, September 2nd. So the rest of the state of Michigan, largely white, vote November 5th. Detroit, largely black, vote September 2nd. Amazing. Everybody's saying, it's just a mistake. Just a simple mistake. And it may well be. Who knows? It could just be.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
But it's no mistake at all that on the Souls to the Polls Day, Sunday before Election Day, that North Carolina just said, that day it's illegal to vote. Hey, I want to know your take. So if you have a comment or question for our radio or TV show, grab your phone or turn on your computer, point the camera at your own face, hit record, and send your videos to yourtakemytake@gmail.com. Don't want to be seen on TV? Then leave a voice message on our rant line at 202-536-5306 and tune into The Big Picture every Thursday night for our Your Take, My Take live segment. It's talk media for the rest of us, the Tom Hartman Program. You know, the rest of us, it's like more than 70% of Americans think Social Security should be strong. More than 80% of Americans think Medicare should. You know, it's the vast majority of Americans think that people should have the right to organize into a union. The vast majority of Americans think that you look at wealth distribution, most Americans think that America has a wealth distribution similar to that of Sweden. They would like it to be even better than that. It's actually far, far worse. It's like the rest of us is most of us. Anyhow, I'm proud to represent most of us. Carol in St. Paul, Minnesota. Hey, Carol, thanks for listening to Minnesota's Progressive Talk. What's up?
Oh, hey, Tom. Let's see. I was at a rant stage when I first called in. I've kind of calmed down a little bit, but I've got about 3 points I really want to get across. And number one is I think we're probably about the same age, and I know when I was doing OJT in my eventual career.
What's OJT?
On-the-job training.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I'm sorry.
There was talk at that time of a 32 to 36-hour work week. And pensions and people having more free time and how they would be using that free time. And then Ronald Reagan was elected, and that all went away.
That's
and
right.
Now, in one of your first comments, you talked about people, you know, governments used to be less paying, and people took the jobs because of the benefits. I'm a teacher because of the benefits and because eventually I'll get an extra reward, or I work for the police, or I work for the fire. Mm-hmm. And now the people who have given up, other unions who have given up stuff, and people who have given up stuff, instead of screaming, why don't I have a pension? They're saying, take it away from that guy.
I know.
The government guy shouldn't have a pension.
I know. It's because the billionaires have seeded, you know, they have planted amongst us, whether it's Fox News, right-wing talk radio, all these right-wing commentators, who are all very well paid, by the way, they have placed these people among us to foster basically class hatred. And the class that they're saying, you know, don't hate the rich, hate the people who are making more than $45,000 or $50,000 a year. And, you know, who hate the people who have a pension. You know, and then you're right. And by the way, your comment, Carol, about the reduced work week, it was 1968. I remembered it. And Sam Sachs used to work on our TV show. He's now gone on to become his very own news correspondent over at RT. But he used to work on our TV show and as one of our producers. And I tasked him with the job once. I said, you know, Sam, I remember this. I remember reading it when I was 17 years old. And, you know, I remember it was within a couple of years of 68. And it was Time Magazine, and I believe it was a cover story, and it was called The Coming Leisure Society. And it was about how they tracked productivity and wages over the previous 50 years or so. And they said if productivity continues to go up, you know, we used to have the 60-hour work week, and then we had the 50-hour work week, and then we have the 40-hour work week. And they said if productivity continues to rise, that by the year 2000, the average American is going to be making around $80,000, $85,000, $90,000 a year, and they're going to be working a 32-hour week. And I said, can you track that down? And it took him about a week, maybe a week and a half, and we eventually got a copy through eBay, as I recall. And he found the article. And sure enough, they were predicting that in Time Magazine, and that was the promise that was being made to the boomer generation, to those people who were alive and around in the 60s and working, was that over time, things have always gotten better for working people. Working people have always gotten better pay. They've always gotten more benefits, and it's going to continue that way. And the only way to absorb the extra money that's going to come out of all this added productivity is a consequence of computers and robots and everything else that's coming down the road. The only way to absorb that extra money is to reduce the work week. And instead, of course, what they did was they sucked it all out for the CEOs and the Mitt Romneys of the world, and they started, you know, playing shell games with corporations and figuring out all the ways that they could steal that money from us, you know, from working people. But, you know, you tell kids these days, I've got some 20-year-olds who work for me, and you tell them about this, and they're like, really? You know, people really thought that? I mean, that was the promise of the government? Serious economists were saying that? Yeah. You know.
Yeah. And then one, just a quick one on the post office. Yeah. If people think about this, the post office is the only organization with the capacity to go to every single address in this country every single day or 6 days a week, every week, week after week after week.
Mm-hmm.
And if we lose that capacity, what does that do? Because UPS and FedEx don't do that. The post office does that for them.
Right.
And the other piece of it is, When are we going to stop talking about government like it's a business? It's a nonprofit. You yep. do not run a nonprofit the way you run a business.
That's right. The Postal Service is a service, not a, you know, not a corporation. It shouldn't be, actually. And that was the stupidity of the partial privatization of the post office back in the 70s or 80s. And it continues. Very well said, Carol. Thank you very much for that. Khalil in Dublin, Virginia. Hey, Khalil, what's on your mind? You want to talk about the senator who slipped in that post office provision?
Listen, this is who's behind all of this, Tom.
Mm-hmm.
And this is who's behind it, the Obama administration. Now, let me also say this. They're behind the vote. We're talking about the voting rights situation. The Obama administration is behind this. Now,
yeah. No, wait a minute. The Obama administration is behind something that was slipped into the post, into legislation when George Bush was president?
No, I'm talking about the Obama administration is behind why it happened, why it occurred. They actually are behind it. Now, listen to this. It will be overturned. It will be overturned. And it will be overturned. Now, this is something. Can I make another point, sir?
Certainly.
All right. And I'd love to hear what you think about this after I make this point. We can change all of this by using our brainwaves, and this is how it's going. I'm telling you this. This will be overturned.
Yeah.
Because we have the ability with our brain to make things occur. Some of us, not all of us.
Yeah. Khalil, I would, you know, respectfully, I would submit that it doesn't need to be that esoteric. That the simple reality is that when about 20% of the population starts to seriously believe things, something changes. Things change. I mean, that's a fairly well documented phenomena. And whether that is because we're all knitted together, you know, through the skeins of time and space, to paraphrase Edgar Cayce, in one kind of collective consciousness, or whether that's just how social animals work, or, you know, whether it's a law of physics or biology or electronics, I don't know. But it's there and it's real, and I don't think it takes special people to do it. I think it's just all of us. But Khalil, thank you for the call, and thank you for your kind comments. Jerry, got to hit the button here. Always helps if you hit the right button. Jerry in Long Island, New York, listening on WWRL. What's up, Jerry?
Yeah, how you doing? Yeah, I'd like to discuss the NYPD stop and frisk policy. And first of all, I'd like to preface my remarks by complimenting the federal judge in this case.
Yes.
I think she got it absolutely, she got it right, and she should be applauded. But in addition to that, I think what's more, both the NYPD stop and frisk policy and the NSA's phone record surveillance program, which seem like very different programs than they are, they have at least one problem in common. And that one problem, in my opinion, that they have in common is this wrong and this very mistaken mindset that far too many people have today in American politics, that in order to keep us safe, it's okay and necessary for government institutions such as the NSA on a national level and also the police departments on a local level to violate the highest law of our land, the U.S. Constitution and its Fourth Amendment. But this mindset it's very faulty and problematic, in my opinion, because, first of all, in addition to the constitutional issues involved, this mindset ignores the facts such as there being a lack of any real genuine evidence that either NYPD stop and frisk policy or the NSA's phone record surveillance program, there's a lack of any evidence that they actually accomplish their purported purposes.
You're right.
For instance, I mean, if you look at the NYPD's stop and frisk policy, a lot of people don't realize it was never intended to get marijuana off the streets. Instead, it was intended to get illegal guns off the street. And the facts and figures clearly show that only a small fraction of 1% of all individuals stopped and frisked by the NYPD as a result of this stop and frisk policy, only a small percentage of them, 1/15 of 1%, are actually found to be in possession of illegal guns or other firearms.
And at the same time, while Mayor Bloomberg is saying stop and frisk is the reason that crime has been going down in New York City, the fact of the matter is that crime has been going down all across the entire United States for the last roughly 20 or 30 years, and it appears that the principal reason for that was Ralph Nader and people like him who campaigned to get lead taken out of gasoline, and that as the lead was taken out of gasoline and it was taken out of the paint that was used in homes and children's cribs and children's toys, You had fewer and fewer children whose neurological systems were damaged by lead at a young age, which seems to predispose people to violence. And the reason that we know this is we're looking at the statistics here in the United States, but other countries took the lead out of the gasoline 10 years earlier, and other countries took it out 10 years later, and they're both seeing the exact same curve, crime dropping in one case 10 years earlier and one case 10 years later. So it seems to be a direct correlation to lead. It's got nothing to do with stop and frisk. Jerry, thanks for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
The wonders of epidemiology. And this is how, you know, Mayor Bloomberg is using basically phony statistics to promote his program that I think is racist. Let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service. TalkRadioNews.com brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com, where you can give a goat to help a rescued slave, and literally a slave. We're talking Sudan and South Sudan and the Darfur area, and receive a photo of your goat and the person you helped, this little charity put together by Ellen Ratner, who happens to be on the line with us. Hey, Ellen.
Well, hi. It looks like Daryl Issa's at it again. He now is sent a letter to Lois Lerner from the IRS.
Wait a second. Let me start over again. Who's at it again?
Daryl Issa.
Oh, Daryl Issa. Oh, my. Okay.
And he has requested from her personal emails.
Personal?
Because she says that she has sent official emails from her personal account, and he wants to know what they are.
Was he, who made him Lord God Inquisitor?
He made himself Lord God.
I see. Yeah, okay. This is the Star Chamber. I mean, this is bizarre. Okay, so how is she going to respond, you know?
We don't know, but obviously she is now on administrative leave. I mean, he would have to find some reason to compel her. I'm actually sitting here looking at former Congressman Bob Ney. We're together up in New York State here, and both of us are saying, I mean, he's just on a fishing expedition.
Oh, of course he is, but the reason that he can use, that he can cite, is that Republicans control the House of Representatives. He has a majority on his committee. He can enforce a subpoena.
Well, he can force a subpoena, but she'd have her attorney. She could claim the Fifth. I mean, there's 100 things she could do.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we'll keep watch this space. We'll keep an eye on this. Keep us up to date.
Hill News is reporting that Edward Snowden, in an interview with the New York Times Magazine, which obviously has not been published yet, accused the United States of targeting reporters at 9/11 who did not agree with the United States. Now, it would have to be certain kinds of reporters because, obviously, some of us were on the air at that time and didn't agree, and maybe we were targeted and maybe we weren't, but there is this accusation out there, and he's doing interviews, which is very interesting.
Well, Helen Thomas paid a pretty heavy price. Bill Maher got thrown off the air. Now, arguably, Bill Maher is not a reporter. Phil Donahue got thrown off the air, arguably not a reporter, but
maybe I'm too much of a little fish and they don't care.
Well, it could be, or maybe they just, you know, were watching you and figured that you hadn't quite stepped over the line like the, you know, Judy Miller might have, although she helped sell that war. I have kind of mixed feelings about her and what happened, but interesting. It's going to be interesting to see, you know, what he says to back that up. And I'm surprised, frankly, he's talking to anybody after Putin told him to keep his head down and shut up.
Well, that's what surprised me because, I mean, that's going to get him thrown out of Russia unless he had given that interview beforehand and it is somehow just now leaked.
Yeah,
that's
which
also another possibility.
Yeah, that makes a certain amount of sense.
Okay, on some other fronts here, a federal court, and this is the U.S. District Court of Appeals, sometimes called the mini Supreme Court, on a 2-1, went after the Obama administration for delaying a 1982 federal law that they had to make a decision on Yucca Mountain storage. They ordered the National Nuclear Regulatory Commission to accept or reject the application. As you know, this is Harry Reid is just obsessed about this because it is in his state.
Yeah, on the other hand, he's not running for election anymore.
Right, but
yeah,
he's obsessed.
Yeah, I understand.
So that's interesting that, again, a 2-1, and that's off cause called the mini Supreme Court.
Right.
Also, today...
That court, by the way, Ellen, if I may, that court right now has a majority of Republicans on it. Was that a... Yeah. Were those two Republican appointees versus... Do you know anything about the background of the judges?
I don't know who actually decided. I don't know what the breakdown was of who decided what.
Okay.
So that'll come out later today, and I honestly should have looked, but didn't.
Okay.
My fault.
On to the next... No problem. On to the next story.
U.S. Airways and American Airlines... have now been told by the Justice Department, you cannot at this point consolidate. It would be an $11 billion deal with a B. They said that they would be violating antitrust laws, that if they consolidated, airfares would go up, there would be less service, and that would make them the biggest airline in the world.
Right, which is right now United, isn't it?
I believe it was United Continental.
Right, which was the result of a merger, which surprised me that they let it go through. Any idea why they're putting their foot down now and they didn't when United and Continental merged?
I don't know. I mean, except for the fact that there may be something more about this merger. I mean, the fact is that the Continental did do a lot of international, so did United, but their roots were not as extensive if you really take... the American Airlines routes, which are extremely extensive, and
right.
then U.S. Airways with all of their connecting, their partnerships.
Right.
I think when you look at the partnerships, that's what does it.
I see. Okay.
And I know a little bit about aviation from Shalene. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, this is my sort of, I don't know how to say this, but it's very interesting. What's going on with Benghazi? Originally, I thought, okay, this is just the right wing making a lot of noise.
Mm-hmm.
But as I have found out more information, it looks like now we know, as you know, that there were CIA agents there.
Yes.
And it looks like a couple things may have been going on. One is that the right wing is saying that there were stolen missiles, and these stolen missiles were coming out of Libya and into Syria, and the United States was trying to get a handle on that. I have, however, also heard from two separate sources that they believe that there was gun running going on, and the CIA was kind of doing that in the same kind of way that we've seen happen in other places.
I mean, like back when the CIA was running guns to Nicaragua during the Reagan administration?
Exactly.
So who were they running the guns to?
Was Syria.
Is Benghazi physically close to Syria? Forgive my geographic ignorance.
It's in Libya, so that, of course, you can get to the Mediterranean that way.
Right, right.
Anyway, there's a lot more to the Benghazi story than is currently going, and it's not just the right wing that should be concerned about it.
Very interesting. Thank you for that, Ellen.
You're very welcome.
Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com. And we will be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Well, we've all heard about the crimes of the banksters, but how much do we really know? You know, sort of like the old fire sign theater thing about, you know, you think you know what's going on, but everything you know is wrong. Could it be that everything we know is wrong about the banksters and the housing situation in the United States? Lynn Simoniak is with us. She's an attorney, president and founder of the Housing Justice Foundation. The website is thjf.org, as in the Housing Justice Foundation, thjf.org. And Lynn, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Thanks for joining us. Your mortgage documents are fake?
Well, yes, they probably are. And that
applies to pretty much everybody who's listening or watching right now.
That's especially true if you refinanced or got a mortgage any time from 2004 through 2008, which is the era of extreme securitization in America.
This is when the banksters were running wild.
Sure. Absolutely. And to this day, we don't have a handle on just how wild they were running. I mean, we know vaguely that they caused the crash of the American economy. But when you ask anyone for some real specifics about mortgage-backed trusts, securitization, all these bundles of mortgages that investors purchased, most people have very little idea of what this was, despite the fact that it was the major driver of our economy and our economic collapse.
Right. So what did you learn, and how did you learn it, and why did you learn it?
Well, what I learned was that Wall Street was so busy buying mortgages and bundling them into investments for that they would register with the SEC, that a lot of the things that were promised to investors regarding safeguarding of the loan documents were never fulfilled. So one of the things that I discovered was that just the extent of the problem. In 2006 alone, Wall Street made over 1,000 of these bundles. And you have to understand, each bundle had about 5,000 mortgages in it. And it was quite common for the total amount of the mortgages to be about $1 billion. I believe that the total amount of mortgage debt securitized just in 2006, how many loans did we put into these packages, was close to $1 trillion, $885 billion in 1 year, which is equivalent to one-tenth of the U.S. total mortgage debt. So we were a train going down a track we had never been on before, and we were going as fast as we possibly could to make
now,
these products.
You learned this because of your own personal experience with the banksters, is that right?
Yes.
I used to say,
I've had a settlement since then, but I used to say my name is Lynn Simoniak and I'm in foreclosure, like it was the beginning of an AA meeting, because so many people are so ashamed of their financial situation that they would never admit that they were in foreclosure. But I felt like I came to mind very honestly. My economic situation was really brought on first by my own illness, where I was unable to work for a couple of years because of a fight with cancer a long time ago, 12 years ago. But then, like millions of other Americans, I had an elderly mother, she was 86 years old, who was no longer able to care for herself. She had Alzheimer's and Parkinson's, and I moved her in with my into my household and began taking care of her with my children, which is a very common scenario, but that's related to our health care situation in this country. And eventually I got to the point where it was very difficult for me to make my mortgage payment, and then my loan adjusted. I had an adjustable rate mortgage. My loan adjusted. I felt that it had adjusted on an improper date, because I had read the mortgage documents and knew what 2 months it could adjust on, and they missed the adjustment date. And rather than wait for their next opportunity under the contract, they decided that I would just go. They would go ahead and adjust it the following month.
Right.
And I protested that and said, no, the contract says your opportunity is March and September. You missed,
right,
and therefore you have to wait till September. And they said, well, now you owe us a late fee.
Uh-huh. And you're a lawyer. You know how to read a contract, so you're pretty sure you were right.
Yeah, I was pretty sure I was right. I am a lawyer. I've been practicing law for 34 years, and the contract was pretty plain. They had two dates which they could adjust, and they missed an adjustment date, which is not uncommon, especially since the servicing rights to mortgages were being transferred very, very rapidly around the country. So when I said, no, I'm not going to pay this additional $1,000 a month, then 3 months later, I was sued for foreclosure. But the surprise to me was who sued me. I had been paying Option One Mortgage Company. I had gotten my mortgage through Option One. But I was sued by somebody called Deutsche Bank National Trust Company as trustee for Soundview Home Loan Trust 2006 OPT1, and I thought, oh my gosh, what is that? I mean, and I had some financial savvy about me. I'd worked in the insurance industry, and I'd worked in banking a little bit, and I had no idea what that was. And in that regard, I am also like tens of thousands of Americans who are suddenly sued by a trust that they never knew owned their mortgage.
Mm-hmm. So you tried to track down, we just have a couple minutes left here, Lynn. So you tried to track down who actually owned your mortgage, and it turned out that that was pretty hard to do, and they started faking documents and throwing them at you.
Right. You know, like everyone else, I got the allegations. We have your note. We had your note. We lost your note. And then 18 months later, what we call the aha moment, we found your note, and we not only found it, we found an endorsement. We found a mortgage assignment, and that's how I discovered this woman, Linda Green, which was just a name used by a mortgage servicing company, you know, by at least 20 different people signing names on mortgage documents.
One of these robo-sign things.
Right, creating documents just out of thin air that should have been safeguarded in trust.
Now, this is a crime. Forging a document is a crime. Did this bank or anybody at this bank go to jail?
Well, as a matter of fact, probably the one of the few people in the industry to go to jail, the president of this company, Lorraine O'Reilly Brown, was sentenced to 5 years 2 months ago, and she's now in a camp fed. She also was sentenced to, I think, 2 to 20 years in Michigan for racketeering for the same crime. But you know, it is as if Deutsche Bank had no idea that any of this was going on. Well,
right.
Of course they did, because banks, judges in Ohio and other states were throwing their cases out left and right, saying you can't prove you own the mortgage.
Right.
And Deutsche Bank has never been brought to task, never been made answerable for using any of these documents.
So the carry home message, Lynn, we're at our last minute here. We're talking with Lynn Simoniak, president and founder of the Housing Justice Foundation, THFJ.org. What should people do if they're having problems with their banks and they suspect that the bank doesn't actually even know who owns their document?
Well, they need to send a demand letter to the servicers explaining that they need copies of these documents. They need to go into their official county records. There are some terrific county recorders, Jeff Thigpen and John O'Brien. Both have websites. Both explain these kinds of frauds and document fraud.
Do you have information about this on your website, Lynn?
Themselves.
Do you have information about this on your website?
I sure do. And, you know, there's others. There's Foreclosure Hamlet, Foreclosure Fraud. So there are websites around MS Fraud. There are websites around the country that talk about all these issues and how to identify fraudulent documents. But most likely, you have a fraudulent mortgage assignment, and most likely your note was never endorsed by the person who should have endorsed it.
Amazing. Amazing. If you got a mortgage between 2004 and 2008.
Yes.
Lynn Simoniak, check out our website, THJF, as in the Housing Justice Foundation, thjf.org. Lynn, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Keep up the great work. Keep spreading the word.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Wow. Hundreds of thousands, perhaps over a million phony mortgages out there right now. Yours might be one of them. Defending America from the weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman here with you. And, you know, there's a primary going on today in New Jersey. And Roger in Highbridge, New Jersey, voted in it. Hey, Roger.
Hey, how are you?
Just great. You have a story to tell?
Well, I noticed when I got my ballot that they had moved our polling place, which has been in the same place for about 20-some-odd years, at least, since I've lived here.
Mm-hmm. Is this a largely Democratic or largely Republican polling area?
It is a largely Republican county.
Okay.
But I Googled that later, and I found out that they moved polling places all over the state.
Hmm.
I got, you know, I just Googled, you know, polling places moved in New Jersey, and I got a page and a half full of towns where they moved the polling places.
Right.
And it just struck me as interesting that we would suddenly move all these places.
I wonder if that might have had something to do with redistricting, with gerrymandering.
It would seem, well, I mean, this is a town of 3,700 people.
Right. But they redraw districts around places all the time. And I frankly don't know. I'm just speculating out loud here. But the Constitution requires every year that ends with zero that the census be taken. And then, you know, over the next few years, I forget what the specific requirement is, maybe within the decade, that the state legislature of each state has to redraw those districts, those congressional districts, so that there's a relative balance among each of the districts in the state, so that the same each state representative or each U.S. representative and state representative is representing roughly an equal number of people. And typically that happens in the second or third year after the census.
I mean, the last time I voted most recently was at the same place as always. So it just, just struck me as interesting that all over the state polls were being moved.
Yeah, it may be that that's happening all over the country as a result of gerrymandering, but or redistricting is the polite word for it. but it could be that there's something odd. If you lived in a very Democratic district and you've got a Republican governor, then I might be more likely to smell a rat. But if it's a Republican district, they're going to probably do everything they can to make...
County-wise, it's pretty Republican.
Yeah, they're probably going to do everything they can to make it easy for you to vote. But, Roger, thanks for the heads up. I'm going to start listening for those kind of things. You've sensitized me to it, and I'll report back as time goes on. Maybe other people will call in with similar stories. Thank you very much for calling. Steve in Chicago. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Thank you. I wanted to make 2 points, if I might. One with regard to your previous guest or caller. I'm not sure which it was, but... I think we need to be wary in terms of being intellectually honest, because I think the right has offered up a whole slew of conspiracy theories with regard to Benghazi, and I don't think it serves us to offer up a sort of counter-narrative that is just as conspiratorially minded without any substance.
Well, Ellen is not a commentator. She's a reporter, and if Ellen says that, it's starting what's starting to come out, not from Daryl Issa, but just, what's starting to come out is that the CIA might have been up to no good in that area. That doesn't mean that there was anything, that doesn't necessarily reflect badly on the president or anybody else. It's just a news story.
Well, it does seem to be a counter-narrative. At least that's the way I read it in terms of...
Well, it could be.
But, again, I think the point I'm making overall is, let's be wary. Let's not use the same standards.
Let's keep in mind, above all else, that the reason, there's only one reason Daryl Issa is talking about Benghazi as if he had a tick, and that is that Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State. Hillary Clinton, in all probability, is going to be the Democratic nominee in 2016. And if they can, and the Secretary of State had two of her employees, basically, State Department employees, murdered and two of their bodyguards killed. And if the Republicans can use that to smear her the way that they smeared her husband relentlessly when he was president, they will. And
exactly. The game of politics isn't the game of checkers, it's chess. And it's thinking, eight moves down the road.
Yep.
The second point I wanted to make was with regard to the notion that economists offered up a sort of workers' utopia decades ago, and that is true, but as many public policy analysts say, economists were created to make astrologers look good. it fails to take into account the fact that, we came out of the Second World War having pretty much the only industrial base in the world. Western Europe had been decimated, Asia had been decimated, and at the same time, you saw the ascendancy of the labor movement, such that for several decades, it was the case that, looking at it from a purely American standpoint, yes, we were going to live this great life in which, working hours were going to come down, leisure was going to go up, all of these things. Until we recognized that at some point our competitors were going to rebuild and a modern global economy, capital is mobile.
Steve, you're respectfully, you are wrong. First of all, the devastation of Europe and Asia and all those things was substantial, but there was a lot of the world and a lot of Europe and Asia that was still relatively intact, a lot of it industrial. And if anything, if we had had free trade agreements back in the 50s, those people would have represented a substantial competition in terms of cheap labor. Number one. Number two,
we produced over half of all the goods and services in the world, 51%.
Sure. And we also consumed them. Which was my second point, which is that if you look at our trade figures, you will see that while exports did go up after World War II, and they went up substantially in real dollar terms, as a percentage of our GDP, it was only a couple of points. The vast majority of the economic activity that happened after World War II that you can attribute to World War II came about as a result of pent-up demand, came about as the result of people not having bought anything for almost a decade, or half a decade anyway, while the war was being bought. People didn't buy new appliances. They didn't buy new cars.
The Marshall Plan, and the fact is that there was no other source wherein persons could buy.
But see, prior to that, there was no other source. We had very, very protectionist policies in the United States. And in the 1920s and the 1930s and in the 1800s, through that entire period, when you bought things in America, typically they were made in America. And about the only stuff that you bought that was made outside the United States was silk or French wine. I mean, it was rare stuff. So it wasn't like all of a sudden, you know, like it wasn't like today where you know, China just went away as a major competitor. China was never there, or Japan, or Western Europe, for that matter, as a major competitor. In the 1940s, you did not see Mercedes-Benzes on the streets of the United States. You didn't see Hondas. You didn't see Toyotas. It wasn't like our competition went away. They weren't our competition. The competition in the United States was one American company versus another American company. So, you know, go back and look at the trade figures, at the import-export figures in the two decades following World War II. You'll see what I'm talking about. Steve, thanks for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I've heard this for so long from conservatives, by and large, or, you know, and it's just not right. The good, the bad, and the very, very ovo-vivaporously ugly, the good, Jerry Brown. On Monday night, the California governor signed into law the nation's first transgender student rights bill. From now on, Golden State schools will have to provide all students, regardless of their gender identity, equal access to all sports teams, extra athletic facilities, and extracurricular activities. The history of America is a history of expanding rights, and California and its governor should be commended for leading the charge when it comes to rights for transgender Americans. The bad. Children's Healthcare of Atlanta. The Atlanta-based medical center is denying 15-year-old Anthony Stokes a heart transplant because, you guessed it, he has bad grades. According to hospital officials, he doesn't fit the requirements for the transplant list because he has, quote, a history of non-compliance. If Anthony doesn't get a new heart sometime soon, he has about 6 months to live. If Sarah Palin is still looking for those death panels in the Obamacare text, she can stop looking because they already exist in America's privatized, business-first healthcare industry. Children's Healthcare of Atlanta should be ashamed of themselves. And the very, very ugly, who else but Congressman Steve King? During a recent speaking appearance, the Iowa congressman let his supporters know how he really feels about immigration and immigrants. According to Politico, King told a Richmond, Virginia crowd that, quote, if you bring people from a violent civilization into a less violent situation, you're going to have more violence, right? It's like pouring hot water into cold water. Does it raise the temperature or not? End quote. This is race baiting at its very worst. The vast majority of undocumented workers in the United States just want to earn enough money to support their families. Saddest thing is Congressman King won't get anything more than a slap on the wrist for his comments, because as much as the House Republican leadership pretends to be embarrassed by this sort of stuff, it needs people like Congressman King to ramp up the race hate and thus solidify the Republican Party's base. And that is just very, very ugly. It's amazingly ugly. Okay, one last news story here, and I just want to give you a quick take on it, and then back over to your calls. The part of Obamacare was that there was a cap on out-of-pocket costs, that you would never pay more than a little over $6,000, your whole family would never pay a little more than $12,000 in any given year, no matter how sick you got, no matter what happened. That's in the Obamacare law. And back in February, they suspended that for a year. They put it off until 2014, or maybe 2015. Anyhow, they bumped it back a year. The reason they bumped it back, they said, and they continue to say, they being the Obama administration, is because the health insurance companies tell them that their computers don't talk to each other really well, and they can't calculate how much you have spent out of pocket, so they can't know when to stop charging you. Now, many of us think this is a nonsensical argument because all of the health insurance companies have caps. They calculate caps. They keep track of what you've paid and what they've paid. So they already have the ability to do this. But nonetheless, the administration said, okay, we'll give you a year to get your act together. Now, consider this. What the administration basically said is to the health insurance companies, you can charge anything you want in terms of out-of-pocket expenses. So they can charge you $30,000 a year, $50,000 a year, $100,000 a year. As long as it's disclosed in the policy that you buy up front, they can charge you whatever they want or make you pay out-of-pocket, whatever they want. Somehow, the Republicans are trying to turn this into a criticism of President Obama and Obamacare. Just think about this for a minute. The Republicans are saying there's something wrong with Obamacare because the health insurance companies are going to be allowed to rip you off for one more year. Because Obamacare is postponing health insurance companies from ripping you off, because that's being postponed for a year, because the health insurance companies are saying, we can't make our computers work, we're so sorry. The Republicans are saying, ha-ha, proof, Obamacare is all screwed up. I guarantee it'll be all over Fox News tonight. Look at this, we got a problem with Obamacare. People are going to be paying a massive amount of money out of pocket. And don't the Republicans realize that when they attack Obamacare for this, what they're attacking is the current system that they say they want to enshrine by getting rid of Obamacare? I mean, if you defund Obamacare, the insurance companies are going to be able to rip you off forever. Somehow, Sean Hannity is going to turn this into a scandal tonight. I guarantee it. And Bill O'Reilly and all the other bozos over at Fox. It's going to be amazing. It's going to be amazing. Jeff in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Jeff, what's up?
2 points about voting. When you mentioned voter disenfranchisement, I really think we need a new meme there. The language is too benign. It doesn't convey the
Yeah, I've stopped issue. Using the word disenfranchised to the extent that I can.
What we should do is call it voting prevention and voter elimination.
Good one. I just say, knocking people off the rolls, keeping people from voting. I try to turn it into really simple English.
Yeah, because what it is, it's voting prevention. They're preventing people from voting. It's not.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the sole.
Or voting denial.
And what strangely it brings up this thing of when you say, well, maybe it's an accident about the billboards in Detroit reporting the September 2nd voting day. Well, strangely, all these accidents tend to favor Republicans, such as misinformation voting day, tossed registration forms, machine miscounts, vote-changing machines, etc. Too few polling centers. And one thing a lot of people, it isn't making the news right now very much, but a GOP candidate was just sentenced to for felony fraud after changing party affiliation on 300 absentee ballots and then casting those ballots for those people.
So there is voter fraud. It's the Republicans who are doing it.
Well, everything we find, it tends to be the Republicans.
Where did that happen, Jeff? Massachusetts.
Massachusetts.
The primary
is Massachusetts, which brings up another huge point. I mean, I know you like the mail-in ballots in Oregon, but last thing I would trust electronic machines probably more than mail-in in many cases.
Yeah.
But mail-in ballots are very prone to fraud.
Yeah. Well, and we saw this in the UK. There was a ring of people who were, buying them up and selling them off. But
see, there's another problem with paper ballots. They are counted by machines, such as the mail-in ballots. So it's not the way that we cast the vote; it's the way it's counted that matters.
Yes. To paraphrase Joe Stalin, it doesn't matter how they vote; it matters who counts the vote.
Paper ballots are counted, and the thing is, an absentee ballot, you mark with a pencil or pen. Well, if you're not unsure about election, people often leave the ballot blank there.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody then can pencil in that race.
Right.
So and that's just a really easy, undetectable thing that can happen at any level of the game.
Right. Yeah. There's.
But anyway, so if you look around and you see all these problems and look at Don Siegelman, I can't say always because I'm not absurd, but I cannot think, and I've been dealing with this issue for a decade now.
Yeah.
I cannot think of a single time where it favored the Democrat.
Yep. I'm with you, Jeff.
And,
I'm with you. Something is rotten in it ain't Denmark. It's the United States, tragically. Jeff, thank you for the call. Well said. Seth in Blacksburg, Virginia. Hey, Seth, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how are you?
Fine. What's on your mind?
Can you hear me well?
I do. It sounds a little buzzy electronic, but otherwise fine.
Okay, I'm on Skype, so I always wonder if you can hear me.
Okay, yeah.
I have a dream. The Industrial Revolution up until World War II, capitalism mainly resolved needs. Would you agree with that?
Yes and no. I would say it mainly resolved needs for white people, for the ruling class, basically. Yes.
Well, I'm speculating that it mainly resolved needs for the bulk of the population. That's what it was.
Yeah, I think there was a general improvement in quality of life across the United States, Western Europe. Yeah.
Right. And now it's focusing on luxuries, and thus it's causing climate change, wage slavery, war, et cetera, et cetera. Its excesses are causing problems that are unprecedented.
I would agree.
Okay. Now, my dream is that I think that as capitalists functioning in society, we should be supported in the economy and education to work at what we love to do to serve the greatest needs of society first, starting in the developing world as requested, in harmony with nature. Luxuries should come later. We should be fostering world peace and address the scarcity of resources.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, I'm putting a finger on what we should be doing rather than run away from these things that we're afraid of.
Yeah.
Like, this is what we should be doing.
Yeah. That's, you know, I completely agree. Well said, Seth. Thank you very much for that. Donna in Columbia, California. Donna, 1 minute to the break. It's yours.
Okay. Good afternoon, Tom.
Hi.
In 2006, this is in regards to the two senators from New York that the woman called in about.
Right.
Being in this piece of, it was Hillary Clinton and Charles Schumer. And
they're not the ones who put the bankster thing in there. Shane has totally deconstructed. He spent the last 3 hours combing through this piece of legislation, and it looks like it was completely anonymous, whoever did this in the Senate.
Okay. But I just called in about those were the two senators from New York in 2006.
Oh, yeah.
In regards to the post office.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yes. And so it was. I guarantee you it wasn't either one of them. This was a Republican.
All right.
It had to be. I mean, you know, the Republicans have supported it ever since. The Republicans have refused all efforts to undo it. The only thing that it did, in effect, was just, you know, destroy the post office and the union there. It stopped them dead in their tracks from their planned project to put electric cars on the roads. I mean, all these things that the Republicans are, you know, help the fossil fuel industry. So, but apparently the wrapper, the Senate bill, the wrapper had this wrapped into it, and we can't find out who it was. Donna, thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And you can drop by TomHartman.com, our live chat room. It's free. It's fun. No, seriously. And some of the coolest minds on earth. Taking back the mainstream media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman here with you, and welcome back. Dwayne in Petaluma, California. Hey, Dwayne, what's on your mind?
Hello, Tom. The figures that they use on the bailout, the $13 trillion, when you match that up to the total amount of mortgages in America, which is closer to $4 trillion, it just makes no sense that it took that much money to cover that many derivatives, unless there's one other possibility, and that is that the mortgages were sold to multiple buyers and being held in multiple of these bundles.
No, certainly that was happening, Dwayne, and individual mortgages were sliced up into little bits and pieces were added to other bits and pieces. It's called tranching, and they were sold off to people. But here's how you go from a couple billion dollars worth of mortgages into $900 trillion worth of derivatives, and it's called leverage. It's like, you know, if you owe me $5 and I'd bet Shano $10 that you're not going to pay me, Shano and I now have a $10 contract, you and I have a $5 contract, then Shano can go to Jim and say, I'll bet you $20 that Tom's not going to pay me. And now they've got a $20 contract. And then Jim can go over to Danielle and say, you know, I'll bet you $50 that Shane's not going to pay me. And, you know, now we got a $50 contract. When you aggregate them all together, we got $80 or $90 in play here, maybe $100 in play, all starting with a $5 bet. And that $5 bet is that original mortgage. Make sense?
That explanation is nice, but it doesn't explain why they're having trouble figuring out and identifying who is the actual owners of the mortgages.
Oh, that's because it was fraudulent.
House mortgage, if it was owned by two or three different trust funds or had been sold off would explain why they need to cover all three of them.
It does in part, but here's a much simpler explanation. Using the exact example that I just gave you, let's say that Shane and I have a $5 bet, and we never reduced it to writing. We never wrote it down. It's just a gentleman's handshake. Or, you know, it was just a letter of intent, but it was never a contract. So we've got this $5 bet. Shane has now turned it into a bet with Jim for $10. Jim has got it with Danielle for $20. I forget the chain now, but it's a $50 bet. And somebody comes along and says, let's prove that this $50 bet, which is based on the $20 bet, which is based on the $10 bet, which is based on the $5 contract, let's prove that it's all solid by looking at that $5 contract. At that point, if Shane's got a $10 bet with Jim, he's got a 2-to-1 stake of keeping the fiction going that he and I actually have a contract, even though we don't. So at that point, not to make Shano the bad guy here, but at that point, Shano's the banker, right? He's the loan originator in this example. What he does is he fakes an IOU, and he fakes my signature on it. And then he shows that to Jim and Danielle and everybody else and says, see, here's the original contract on which all these bets are based, so the bets are good, so don't panic. And then if somebody comes along, and this is what they have been doing, 2004, 2005, 2006, 2007, 2008, this is what they were doing. They were faking these mortgages. That's the whole robo-signing thing. Millions of them, hundreds of thousands of them, certainly, probably millions of them. So then this woman comes along, Lynn Simoniak, who we just had on as a guest, and she says, let me see the actual physical document. I'm a lawyer. I know how to read a contract. And they hand it to her, and she says, this is not my signature. This is not the signature of an officer of the bank. This is not the original language of my loan. You guys forged this. At that point, what the bank did was they gave her several million dollars to go away. And they actually did. Lynn got a settlement of several million dollars to go away and shut up. Stop talking about it. Take your money. You know, go away, be happy. And she took that money, those millions of dollars, and she went back to the original bank. My bet was Shane. She went back to the original bank and she said, I have the money now. I'd like to pay off my house 100%. Can you please give me the original loan document that I signed so that I can pay it off? And they said, we can't. We don't have it. It is lost. And that's the problem, is there's so much fraud in this system. That's the reason, in my opinion, and Shane was sharing this with me, I think he's absolutely right during the break, that's the reason why the banks are forcing foreclosures rather than letting people, you know, buy their houses, you know, repair the mortgage, you know, rather than going along with the government program, the help program and all that. The reason that they're forcing a foreclosure is because when you foreclose on a mortgage, you then take possession of the property and you have clear title, regardless of what had happened, regardless of what kind of hanky-panky had happened before that, and it reboots the system. So if Shane was to come to me and say, you know, you owe me $5 and you haven't paid me, so, you know, I'm going to take that coffee cup on your table because it's worth $5. I got your coffee cup now. And, you know, and then I'm going to sell this coffee cup to somebody else for $5. And he writes an actual contract with Ellen down the hall for $5. And then he goes back to Jim and he says, my $10 bet is now based on a contract with Ellen for $5. But it's the same kind of deal. So your bet with me is good. And Jim can say to Danielle, my bet with you is good, and on like that. That's, you know, the credit derivative system explained, but simply. Go ahead, Dwayne.
That sounds good, but the only other case I know where a bank actually paid off was where they had actually sold the property, the same property that they claimed to own.
Right.
They sold it to two different people, and when somebody caught them on it, they paid off big time.
Yeah.
And that's the point, is why would they pay her off unless they were in a position where two or three people were going to show up claiming ownership of that mortgage and therefore the ability to foreclose?
I think that's what they were afraid of. I think they were afraid that she had the ability to take this thing public enough in a large enough way in a court of law. I mean, if it had gone into a court of law, they settled out of court, and that's why.
Losing a document doesn't, you know, is something they could explain to a jury. Selling the same mortgage to two or three different trust funds, retirement funds, would be an explanation as to why they'd pay her big time to go away.
May well be, Dwayne. And certainly there's that going on, too. Once you're starting with a fraudulent mortgage, anything can happen. Dwayne, thank you for the call. And thanks for participating with me in our little reality example what is that with the puppets behind a shadow curtain? There's a word for it. Anyway, conservatives are always praising American exceptionalism, but in reality, thanks to devastating right-wing policies, America is not number one anymore. I'll challenge libertarian talk show host Tony Styles on that tomorrow. And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It requires your participation. Tag, you're it. Get out there and act. Occupy something. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.